You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg.
You're listening to Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror and science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. Since we'll be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning, listener discretion is advised, etc., especially for this movie. Also, spoilers ahead. Today I'm joined by Irene Bindi. Welcome to the show, and thanks so much for recording with me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Irene Bindi is an artist and editor who works at ARP Books, a radical press that focuses on progressive politics and social justice, as well as experimental literary works in those areas. She has an MA in film studies from York University. She's based in Winnipeg on Treaty 1. This week, we're discussing Pier Paolo Pasolini's film Salo, or The 120 Days of Sodom. On four wealthy, corrupt Italian libertines, the Duke, the Bishop, the Magistrate, and the President, in the time of the fascist Republic of Salò. The libertines kidnap 18 teenagers and subject them to 4 months of extreme violence, sadism, and sexual and psychological torture. The characters are split into groups: the masters, daughters, storytellers, studs, collaborators, and victims. The film explores themes of political corruption, consumerism, authoritarianism, nihilism, morality, capitalism, totalitarianism, sadism, sexuality, and fascism. The story is in four segments, inspired by Dante's Divine Comedy, the Inferno, the Circle of Manias, the Circle of Excrement, and the Circle of Blood. Irene, what is your history with Salò, and why did you choose this movie?
I'll start with the second part of that, because we were talking about a couple of other movies originally potentially do, but then Salò, I think, came up because it's an anti-fascist film, and because it seems like a really good way to wrap up the year.
Yeah.
And it kind of resonates with a lot of things that people are thinking about right now. As far as how I first came to see it, I was doing my MA at York in the early 2000s, and I was working at Suspect Video, and I just brought it home. I was watching a lot of like transgressive cinema, and I had already seen a few Pasolini films and really loved those that I had seen, which were like Catone and Uccellacci Uccellini and The Gospel According to St. Matthew. And I was really enamored with this, with his kind of like, almost like careless. There was like a coolness to it that was different from like the coolness of French cinema, which is like slick or something. But there's this sort of like weird, careless kind of feeling in the the camera work and the way that things kind of rumble around in these films, sort of chaotic feeling. And that was like completely different from what I then experienced with Sallow, which is like full of stasis and these like long static shots and this distance, which I mean, we'll probably talk about in the context of fascist cinema or of fascism and anti-fascism. But yeah, so that was how I first saw it. But I knew of it as like an infamous. Yeah, I don't know if, like, I'm sure the audience knows something about that too, but it was hard for us to even get to seeing it now.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, it's like, it's not available. You can buy like a Blu-ray copy from Criterion, but yeah, it's not available anywhere. And Irene had to drop off a USB at my house. It felt very retro. Yeah. Yeah, so this was my first time watching it. And it was not at all what I expected it to be. I was expecting it to be a lot gorier and bloodier. It is violent, but the way that the violence is framed is very, like, yeah, like you mentioned, like, very distant and very cold. So, yeah, I kind of found it, like, oddly, like, beautiful and very bizarre. The sets and dialogue feel very artificial, yet the story takes place in a very real and horrific time. So, yeah, it has it's just really interesting. And I honestly, like, don't entirely know how I feel about it yet. Like, you mentioned this earlier, but, yeah, it just feels like, yeah, it's haunting. So, yeah, so this film is an adaptation of The 120 Days of Sodom, a novel by French writer Marquis de Sade. Described as both pornographic and erotic, it was written in 1785. Tells a story of four wealthy male libertines who resolve to experience the ultimate sexual gratification in orgies. To do this, they seal themselves away for 4 months in an inaccessible castle in the heart of the Black Forest with a harem of 36 victims, mostly male and female teenagers, and engage four madams, to tell the stories of their lives and adventures. The crimes and tortures in the woman's narratives inspire the libertines to similarly abuse and torture their victims, which gradually grows in intensity and ends in their slaughter. And I just have some background info. So libertines, I didn't know what that was. So a libertine is one devoid of most moral principles, a sense of responsibility, or sexual restraints, which are seen as unnecessary or undesirable, especially one who ignores or even spurns accepted morals and forms of behavior sanctified by larger society. Libertinism is described as an extreme form of hedonism. Libertines put value on physical pleasures, meaning those experienced through the senses. As a philosophy, libertinism gained newfound followers in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, particularly in France and Great Britain. Then just some background on Sallow. The Italian Social Republic, or the Republic of Sallow, was a German puppet fascist state that was created during the later part of World War II, existing from the beginning of German occupation of Italy in September 1943 until the surrender of German troops in Italy in May 1945. Yeah, I think like when they were initially writing the script, they were going to set the film in the 1785, like when the book was set, essentially. But then I think to base it, or to set it in 1945 is like, yeah, it's really interesting to me. And like, even though the film is very bizarre and like uncanny, it is still anchored like in this reality.
Definitely. And Pasolini is always speaking to, I mean, with his other trilogy films that he made, he's always speaking to contemporary Italian society, even though he's pulling from these myths and earlier stories and different mystical contexts and things like that.
So I have a quote here from John Waters in an interview for BigThing.com. So the question was, why should filmmakers make obscene films like Sallow? And John Waters responded, well, to me, Pasolini's not. I don't think Sallow is obscene. I think it can use obscenity in a way to make a point about fascism. I mean, about fantasies, about power, It's a movie, that's a movie about the pornography of power, really. So I think it uses the very extreme sexual subject matter in a very intellectual way. Yeah, I just want to know, like, what do you think of that quote? And, like, this maybe is, like, kind of a big question for only a 1 hour show, but, like, what do you see as, like, the role of these obscene or, like, filthy films?
Yeah. Well, I think there isn't really another film that's, like, the same type of obscene that Cell is. Like, It is a very specific thing. And even though it does, like, deal with so much sexual matter, it is not an erotic film in any way. And it's sort of like, and it, like, it is like what probably, like, the film probably that most explodes the thing that is, like, so interesting about Pasolini, which is that, like, there is this, like, there's all of these, like, divisive, contradictory things about him. Like, that's the defining feature of Pasolini, is, like, controversy around him, where, you know, he was, like, a communist and embraced by the left for many years, and, like, seen as this super extreme figure, and other films of his were banned before this one, etc. He was already super well known, super controversial in Italy, but then also embraced by the right. Now, even more now, the Vatican, they had banned his films, and now they've, like, embraced the ones with religious context. I guess we'll probably get into it a bit more when we're talking in the context of feminism and stuff, but you know, he's, like, pro-life, and so the role of this film as, like, the obscene quality of it, I think it serves, I think the main, like, the thing that I get from that is that it communicates a certain, like, complicity. So the discomfort of it, outside of the very, like, grotesque, you know, the scenes themselves that are so awful, the things that are being depicted, the torture, etc., is the complicity that he's able to craft. So you're not watching torture porn where, like, you're free to just enjoy whatever is unfolding, if that's your thing, because of the way that he treats the camera and, like, we'll get into that a bit more later, but it really does, it makes you complicit, and I think that's the major discomfort.
Yeah, it's definitely an uncomfortable film, and maybe that's, like, why people still have a hard time with it, hard time watching it. I was listening to this one podcast, and one of the hosts was just like, this movie's a piece of shit, it should have never been made, and these filmmakers should be ashamed of themselves, which is, like, that's, I don't know, there's just, like, there seems to be this, like, fixation on goodness and, like, only representing goodness in films rather than, like,
anything,
or if you, like, too unpleasant or too, I don't know, sorry, go ahead.
Or if you represent evil, it has to be presented as evil and as in opposition to whatever the mores, like, the, whatever the moral position of the audience, whereas Pasolini totally does away with that and forces you into the position of the torturers.
Yes, yeah.
Through perspectives and things.
Yeah, it is interesting that you know the most about the masters and, like, the tormentors, the abusers, but we don't really know anything about the victims. Like, we don't really spend any time with them. I found it hard to, like, keep track of their names. And there's really only one character where you know anything. Like, you know that her mother was killed trying to protect her, and she's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a Oh, that is a super interesting little subplot, because he needs that subplot in order to have the scene where she breaks down. So this character's, for people listening, this character's mother is murdered at the beginning when the young people are first kidnapped. Mm-hmm. And she breaks down later on because she's upset because her mother has died. Mm-hmm. The purpose of that scene is to show how much pleasure the libertines get when they see her misery. They are really elated by her crying and upset.
Yeah.
But the unintended kind of side effect of that is that, you know, then we have some feeling for this girl, right? Mm-hmm. We have some sympathy for her.
Yeah.
So later on in the film, there is like a corrective to that, where she is, where like one of the scenes where they're sitting across from each other eating shit at the table. Mm-hmm. Can I have to say it?
you could say shit, I think.
It's really shit.
Yeah.
Where they're sitting, you know, and being forced to each other's table, and one of the other girls is sitting across from her and looks at her and is like, I can't do this mm-hmm. anymore, you know, and she's just like beyond. Mm-hmm. The original girl, the crying girl, the girl whose mother has been murdered, mm-hmm. there was no sympathy for her, and mm-hmm. says, I can't remember exactly what she says, but it's something dismissive and mean, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So our ability to like her mm-hmm. is kind of by that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Just on that note, I was looking into research a little bit on the banality of evil, which is a term coined by political theorist Hannah Arendt? Arendt? Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce her last name. After watching the 1961 trial of Nazi SS officer Adolf Eichmann, this phrase captures the idea that evil acts are not necessarily perpetrated by evil people. Instead, they can simply be the result of bureaucrats dutifully obeying orders. And I feel like this can be seen with the studs and the collaborators, and when the children or the teenagers start turning on each other, or even, I think, what's it, Renata, like, they're sort of, like, her mean comment, or just, like, dismissing this other girl's, like, pain, basically. So, like, basically everyone in this world of the film is capable of cruelty and violence. There's just, like, mm-hmm. yeah, not a lot of humanity in this film.
There's no let up.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is one of the other things. It's sort of like an endurance test mm-hmm. of, like, how much can you handle? You know where this is going, and the sense of dread just grows because mm-hmm. you know the torture is going to get worse, mm-hmm. and then there's going to be killings.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, there are like a couple of moments of like kindness, like whenever the teenagers are kind of like rounded up or scared and together, that you can see them like holding each other or touching each other very gently, and like, so those moments were like very heartbreaking, but like very, very sweet. But mm-hmm. yeah, that's like the only humanity that is shown in this film.
Yeah, it kind of erodes throughout, which mm-hmm. I think is also one of the aspects of what kind of like what the fascism slash homogeneity slash like sorry consumerism mm-hmm. that Pasolini hates so much. Mm-hmm. Homogenizes everything, including like human emotion and interaction, and mm-hmm. just like slowly degrades those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we mentioned this earlier, but in the film, almost no background is given on the tortured subjects, and for the most part, they almost never speak. Pasolini's depiction of the victims was intended to demonstrate the physical body as a commodity and the annulment of the personality of the other. Specifically, Pasolini intended to depict what he described as an anarchy of power, in which sex acts and physical abuse functioned as metaphor for the relationship between power and its subjects. And I was listening to this one podcast called Girls, Guts, and Giallo, where they were discussing this movie, and they described it as like a horror of excess, that there's like only excess, but it exists outside of desire or pleasure. Like, even during like, can you hear, there's like dogs barking outside my window.
The dogs.
Yeah. But there's just like, there's no desire with, can, is portrayed. It's only like, it's only power and it's only violence. Like there's, and even like when the one stud is caught having sex with one of the caretakers or workers or whatever, then he's killed, or they're both killed actually. And I think that's because there was like, they had a desire for each other rather than just wanting to inflict pain and suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that has to be eliminated.
Yeah. Yeah. And even yeah, the, even like the masters themselves, like they don't seem to necessarily be enjoying themselves. It's just about power.
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's a really, there's an interesting kind of speech, mm-hmm. Speech about that in the scene where they've, they've all been forced to go naked on hands and knees and climb up these marble steps on leashes, and they're being forced to eat this food on the ground, and mm-hmm. it's like the president says to the magistrate, I don't know, one of the libertines says to one of the others, like, do you get this now? Like, they're no, like, I'm paraphrasing, but like, I can't, like, no pleasure can be felt without the pain. Like, my only happiness can be in experiencing the fact that these others are in misery. So then I experience something approaching happiness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, that kind of extreme view of power,
mm-hmm.
And that happens while one of them is putting nails into the polenta mm-hmm. to feed, you know, the girl who unknowingly bites into it.
Sai ballare?
No.
Dai, proviamo.
Proviamo un po'.
Come si chiama il tuo ragazzo?
Margherita.
So yeah, this film had a few alternate endings, apparently. So Pasolini shot four different endings. The first was a shot of a red flag in the wind with the words love you, but it was abandoned by the director because he thought it was too pompous and prone to the ethics of the psychedelic youth, which he detested.
Yeah. That's like that's one of those like those things about Pasolini where it's like, well, you would think that he would be with like the radical left of the late 1960s, but he was like famously against like the student protests in May 68.
Yeah,
because he felt that he identified them as the children of the bourgeoisie, yes. these student protesters, and he was more aligned with, he said that, you know, the police and the military, these are the children of laborers, these mm-hmm. are the, you know, which is like, Italian politics anyway is, I kind of derailed what you were saying, we can go into Italian politics.
Yeah, we could talk about Italian politics after. So the second showed all the actors other than the four gentlemen, the director, and his troupe perform a wild dance in a room in the villa furnished with red flags, and the scene was filmed with the purpose of using it as a background scene during the credits. but it was discarded because it appeared in the eyes of Pasolini chaotic and unsatisfactory, which kind of makes sense for how the rest of the film is framed, like very like clean, kind of cold. Another final scene discovered years later, and which was only in the initial draft of the script, showed after the torture's end, the four gentlemen walk out of the house and drawing conclusions about the morality of the whole affair. Finally, keeping the idea of dance as a summation of carnage, Pasolini chose to end with the two young soldiers dancing.
And it's kind of a final scene, even though you're just at that point gutted.
Yeah.
Feeling miserably sick, hopefully, if you're human.
Yeah. Yeah, but it also kind of shows, like, again, this, like, banality of evil, how this cycle is just going to repeat itself. Because it is interesting to see, like, the collaborators and the Steds go along with everything, and or maybe you're just, like, they're glad that they're not the ones being tortured and forced to eat shit. Like, yeah, it is interesting because you don't really spend it. You don't, like, know a lot of, like, the eternal lives of the characters. Like, it is hard to figure out their motivations.
Yeah, they don't. They're just stand-ins, you know? Mm-hmm. I was watching, like, The Night Court, a few other, like, you know, films dealing with similar subject matters from the time that are kind of infamous, like mm-hmm. The Night Porter.
Mm-hmm.
And like the aesthetic of that film feels so like, you know, it's been like criticized as like kind of like Nazi chic.
Yeah, like Nazi exploitation.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And this is definitely not that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can't be accused of being anything like that. And like there's a film that I think like to get into a little bit of like the complexities, like the rabbit hole of Italian politics a bit, it is like kind of deeply incestuous, and like they there was a film made in the mid-60s called La Rabbia, which means the anger,
mm-hmm.
that Pasolini was like, it was sort of like this, the concept behind it was like a thinker of the left pitted against the thinker of the right.
Mm-hmm.
And Giovannino Guareschi, who was like a really famous right-wing journalist and humorist and cartoonist in Italy, was the filmmaker to make the second half of the film, or one half of the film,
mm-hmm.
and Pasolini was to make the other half of the film. And the sort of marketing idea around it was of this sort of like battle between
mm-hmm.
these two, but really, they each made their half of the film in like isolation, and the things that they end up criticizing, and the film, I should say, was banned. It was like nobody wanted this film to come out. The CIA wanted to come out. The Vatican didn't want it to come out. Once it actually came out, it was banned within a few days. The right didn't want it, and the left didn't want it either. But then they also both did want it. Like, there was this other faction that was like, let's band together
mm-hmm.
to make this a thing that can go out into the world. But sorry, my point being that their criticisms end up weirdly aligning,
mm-hmm.
even though like Pasolini's portion of the film is like this really poetical vision, and he really believed in like the strength of ideas and crafting mm-hmm. something through ideas that would have its own power, and he was laying a lot of like did I mention it's a documentary?
Yeah.
it's like a political battle, you know, like the state of the world today kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. And the groundwork that he laid, he thought that doing that groundwork and that plot and the context of like the artist's vision would be like enough to sway. Whereas Gorecki had a, you know, he was like considered like very straightforward. He was like described as having, you know, used sort of like a cudgel to convey his message and very direct. And he just looked at it in a very practical sense and decided to be that the second he wanted the second half of the film. So they both wanted the section that they got. But Gorecki's thinking was, you know, that the Italian public would basically remember the last argument that they heard.
That
go along with the last argument that they heard, which I have to say is kind of like not necessarily wrong. I mean, people do that. I mean, they do that everywhere, right? Anyway, I'm going way off topic with this film, this other film. But I found that really intriguing because of the fact that they were, it was portrayed as this deep gulf. But, and in certain ways, absolutely. But in other ways, Pasolini is kind of conservative. He comes, because he's a traditionalist. They're both traditionalists in different ways, you know. And he was like worried about the loss of this, like, you know, this pristine idea of Italian culture that had existed before.
Interesting.
I think probably the most problematic thing that comes up again and again is his attitudes and portrayals of women. Which I don't feel as dramatically binary about as like a lot of, there's a lot of feminist film scholars who just like, just write him off completely. And I can't really do that. I love these films. I think probably, I mean, it's a bit of a shame I've never seen Medea, which is probably the one that has, that offers the most sympathetic view of a female character. Like, and it stars Maria Callas, who was like, they were close friends, and he's like famously said that she was the only woman outside of, apart from his mother, that he ever loved in his life. Which is kind of a pretty damning.
Kind of bleak.
Pretty bleak. But yeah, pro-life and... and there was also like kind of on a biographical level a difficult thing for him, which happened a couple of years before Salo, which was that his longtime lover Ninetto Davoli left him for a woman. So that came out in a lot of vitriol in his poetry and writing and things after that time. But it was also just like there's sort of like a dark red that creeps in, and you see it at its most extreme in Salo, like a contempt for youth generally. Whereas his earlier films was this like joy and exuberance and sexuality was like celebrated, and there is a kind of deterioration of that. That's an oversimplification, but it certainly is like a thread. And I think it has to do with his disillusionment with that late 60s, early 70s youth culture, and the way that he thought tied with consumerism.
Interesting. There are a couple, there are a few weddings and a few rituals in this film. The first one, I believe, is between two teenagers, and then between one of the masters and one of the teenagers, and then the masters and then their studs all get married. And there was an interview where Pasolini described the tyranny of heterosexuality, which I think is very funny. So it could be seen as like the weddings are like a satirical look on like heterosexual relationships. But yeah, what do you think of the significance of the weddings?
I mean, there is a tyranny of heterosexuality.
Yeah.
To an extent, that's a real thing. And I think the problematic, I can't remember when they're coming up the steps, and is that in advance of one of the weddings, or is that in advance of when they're dressed in like the elaborate women's clothing?
Yeah, that's before. That's when they marry the studs.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of like I don't understand why that. I mean, like. It's like, it's such a deep pit trying to figure out what the hell is going on there.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's super uncomfortable because, like, yeah, I don't know. Sorry, Olivia, that's not good radio.
Yeah, no, it's okay. and then there's one scene, or like, yeah, in one of the weddings, three masters dress as women, like dress and drag. And yeah, like what do you think the drag signifies?
I'm not sure about that. Like in one sense in the film, the women, the older women, the madams who tell the stories, they're sort of like the instigators of violence. Like the women. And they're also the subject of violence more than, like, the females are the subjects of violence more than the males. Even though, like, narratively speaking, everybody's getting the same brutal treatment, you see more happening to the young women than the men. And as far as the brutality. And then, the women storytellers, and I know that this is from the Marquis de Sade's book, 120 Days of Sodom. Their stories are meant to elicit the action, these cruel acts. And so women are kind of like, you know, the sources of evil in this kind of weirdly metaphorical sense. So I think him putting them in women's clothing before that final marriage, and I guess also before, that's like immediately before they actually, you know, do the worst of their torture and then killing, might be, you know, viewed that way as trying to peg evil on women. But I mean, that's like an extreme reading, and I don't actually think that maybe like even consciously, maybe there's some like on some subconscious level, but I think that like his actual practical critique is much broader than that. But it's just sort of like bears consideration in that way.
Yeah,
it's like a really hard film to talk about.
It's a hard film to talk about, and I'm so tired. It's hard to talk about when you're tired.
I'm not doing well either today, so, I mean, yeah.
I don't know what to make of the drag either. Like, when I was watching it, it didn't feel like misogyny. Like, it didn't feel like a misogynist film because, like, everyone was getting treated poorly. Do you know what I mean? But then, yeah, listening and reading more about it and, like, listening to podcasts and stuff, it's like, oh, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's If I didn't know that context about him, I wouldn't think I would find it uncomfortable anyway because of, you know, like the implication that drag is perverse.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the problematic. I guess I could have said that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that seems more like what he's trying to portray or what he's trying to say.
I don't know, because he was not like a supporter of gay liberation. When they come up the steps in women's clothing, the thing that strikes me is that like it seems to be like an implication that is in itself perverse, which is problematic, obviously. And like, he was not like a figure who was, you know, as part of, you know, like his like opposition to like the youth counterculture. He was not like he was openly gay, but he wasn't somebody who was fighting the fights of gay liberation and gender. And he was like, not like that's one of the ways that he was like, you know, pretty conservative. He like the machismo of Italian culture. It was part of his identity too. So yeah, that's like another kind of weird complication when you're approaching him as a figure of the left or the right, you know.
Yeah, still don't know how I feel about this movie, but I like it. It's interesting. I feel like it's like culturally important.
Oh, definitely. And I feel like that the way that it kind of uniquely ropes you in to a complicity that you're like totally uncomfortable with. That resonates with stuff that's going on right now, because complicity is just participation and viewing, and like all of those static shots of just like, you know, we're all in this open hall of like torture and incredible violence, and that's like we're all kind of participating in that.
Yeah, we're all voyeurs in that way.
Yeah, we're doing that here and now, and so that is the thing that I feel like really, really resonates. I think it's related to what we see happening all around us. The more insidious forms of repression are not enacted through overt or political hate, but through systems that facilitate death and oppression under the guise of, you know, like assistance and et cetera. And I'm talking here about like neoliberalism and neoliberal state as, you know, allowing people to die in the streets and all other kinds of. Yeah, that said, like, I love, you know, like, the things earlier about him, like, him as a difficult figure, I think that's, like, part of what keeps people interested in him, and, like, there's a book that came out just a few years ago called, like, Pasolini Framed and Unframed, I think, and it's, like, or just Framed and Unframed. And it's a collection about him as like, because he's, you know, most well known as like a filmmaker and a poet, but he here, you know, but he was like this super well-known, you know, just like as a thinker, and as a journalist, and a person who people paid attention to what he was thinking and saying, basically.
Interesting.
But he's not sanctified for me. And like, I love the way that his films make me feel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a person who like kind of enjoys confusion, his films are really satisfying.
Yeah.
But I think that Sallow is designed, like well-designed, I would say, to thwart satisfaction.
Yes.
Even that kind of satisfaction, because the emotional piece is so dark. There's no redeemability. It's just punishing, and it's meant to be punishing. So I think in that way, it's like really successful.
Totally. And there's no like moral catharsis. Like there's no like revenge. Like the teenagers don't break free and like kill the masters or anything. But you're just like, there's no like moral catharsis. You're just left watching the torture's happening and these two soldiers are dancing and it's just going to like continue.
There's like a film that was released the following year called a Spanish film called Who Can Kill a Child.
Oh, and yeah, I just heard like about that the other day.
A horror movie. It's like it's not an exploitation movie, but it's sort of like I've never thought of these two films in parallel before, like just thinking about this film over the past couple of days. Amazing programmer Kayla Janice showed that film at the Park Theater a number of years ago here. And it's like, it's almost like the inverse of this film, because it's like, it's about these like British tourists who go to this island, and the children have like basically killed all of the adults. So they've taken like, and it is sort of like out in the open. So it just feels like the actual flip of Sallow, where you're in this enclosed space and these youth are being like tortured and dominated. This is like the exact opposite, where the children have taken upon themselves, because of the abuses of the adults, this sort of like ignoring and neglecting and their violence and their own like evils, have decided to eliminate the adults. I don't know. Maybe
awesome. There's I love to think that they like exist in the same universe, these two films.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
And they go off to like take over the world at the end. Like,
oh my God.
Like, all they have to do in order to make another child a child murderer is to look at them. It's like an infection.
Oh, wow. Cool.
But it has like this kind of like austereness to it as well. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I didn't even like read from any of my notes.
No, it's good. It's like, this movie has a lot. There's a lot to talk about, and it's like impossible to cover everything.
So yeah, it is.
If any listeners have any questions or notes or anything we missed, you can email us at bikinidrivein@gmail.com. Follow me on Instagram, Bikini Drive-In, Facebook page, blah, blah, blah. You could also listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday at 4 p.m. on CKW. I just wanted to thank everybody for voting the Bikini Drive-In as Winnipeg's favorite podcast in the Uniter 30 a little while ago. So thanks so much. That means a lot. Irene, thank you so much for suggesting this movie and for talking about it with me.
Thank you. It was fun. We put ourselves in misery.
Yeah, we really did. please come back anytime. This was really fun. Song I hate. It's the song I hate.
stupid man. You got a Ku Klux Klan. Your fucking battle plan. It's the song I hate. It's the song I hate. I see hat and squirt. You're an adventure. Yeah, fascist twerk. It's the song I hate. It's the song I hate. A black robe in swill. I believe Anita Hill. A judge of rotting. A black attack and fire. It's the song I hate. It's the song I hate. And yeah, the president sucks. War pig fuck. Your shit is out of luck. It's the song I hate. It's the song I hate. Another Nazi attack. The skinhead is cracked. My blood is black. It's the song I hate. It's the song I hate. We're banging pots and pans to make you understand. We're gonna bury you, man. It's the song I hate. It's the song I hate. I'm a human wreck, a redneck in check. I killed a teacher's pet. It's the song I hate.
Powered by volunteer community involvement, this is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.